Hello, and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Today, we're on safari for that rarest of beasts, those architectural outliers known as white elephants. The buildings built with the best of intentions, which, over time, through poor conception, spiralling costs, or just unforeseen circumstances, have fallen from favour and out of use. And perhaps what we can learn from these problematic pachyderms. From Jerusalem.
It's a pity that such a great building, which was supposed to be a big symbol for representing the Palestinian people, it's closed and unused.
We report on the city's abandoned Palestinian Parliament building. And in Belgrade.
When you're entering Belgrade, the old town, you can see that white huge tower, which is completely demolished and left like that for years.
We meet an international outfit looking to salvage some use out of white elephant projects and disused buildings across Europe. To round things off, we talk to Grafton Architects, the winners of the Royal Institute of British Architects inaugural International Prize, plus a word with the head of the judging panel, the esteemed British-Italian architect Richard Rogers. All that to come right here on Section D on Monocle 24. So, what is a white elephant anyway? The modern usage hails from Southeast Asia, where kings and queens of yore kept actual in-the-flesh white elephants as symbols of their wealth and prosperity. The story goes that, from time to time, more devious monarchs were in the habit of gifting these prized beasts to courtiers who had fallen from favour. A generous act on the face of it, but in fact a trick, and one that helps inform the phrase's current meaning. Before long, these honoured but ill-fated courtiers were driven to destitution and ruin by the cost of keeping these prestigious pachyderms. What's more, the animals could not be worked or given away. The lesson: what once seemed like a gracious gift or aspired to asset can quickly outlive its usefulness. And as such, the phrase has fallen into the discussion of buildings that have outlived their use and favour, whose owners have no use for them and whose users have no love for them. Places where the scales have tipped from utility and beauty into lameness and largesse, sometimes due to vaulting ambition or rocketing costs, sometimes thanks to unforeseen political or social circumstances. Think, if you will, of Centre Point, a 33-storey George Marsh-designed tower block that's blighted London's busy Oxford Street with its uselessness since completion in 1966. It's a cruelly ironic failure, considering London's piousness against high-rises and the exorbitant expense of the area in which the building sits dormant. Lord knows the city needs the space, but a dearth of commercial interest and a surplus of financial binds have kept the structure from ever living up to its vertiginous potential. In Dubai, the artificial archipelago dubbed The World has fallen from favour and been drawn into the universe of white elephant projects. Started in 2003 and backed by Dubai's ruling family, the project was an expensive and ambitious attempt to extend the Emirates' coastline with a sandy series of offshore islands resembling a scattered and somewhat fuzzy image of the Earth from above. But the financial crisis of 2008 soon scuppered this half-done hash 4 kilometres off the coast of Jumeirah. Today, 40% of the 300-plus islands remain bare and undeveloped, as the sand that was piled high to form them slowly slips back into the Arabian Gulf. So-called starchitects aren't immune from falling foul of white elephant projects either. Spanish architect, painter and sculptor Santiago Calatrava has courted contempt with various projects that have promised much but were delivered over budget and after deadline. His Constitution Bridge over Venice's Grand Canal took 12 years to build and was delivered 3 times over budget, while the City of Arts and Sciences in his native Valencia quadrupled its intended budget. Today, its crumbly roof and the perceived shoddiness of the workmanship has done little to soothe tensions. The point here is not to delight in the failures and foibles of architects and builders, but rather to signal a fresh perspective in how we think about white elephant projects. The advent of adaptive reuse is a heartening one, Plus, the recent nixing of expensive outliers such as the late Zaha Hadid's intended Olympic Stadium in Tokyo and the revolt here in London against the mooted Garden Bridge show a sensible turn in the world of white elephant watching, one in which we're all entitled to be observant. Architecture and property development are and will remain an expensive business. But the elephant in the room is that these icons can't be dubbed such by their creators or their financiers. It takes familiarity, time, use, and a bit of public support to become popular. Buildings should serve the people who reside in them and the places in which they themselves reside. There's no predicting the future, but our top tip for avoiding white elephant projects? Be like the idiomatic elephant himself and be mindful. Remember the overspends, overreaches, and pitfalls of the past. Coming up on the show, a few examples to lean on from around the world. First up on the show, we head to Jerusalem, a city where nearly every building is loaded with historical or political significance. That includes the empty ones. 20 years ago, with the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks in full swing, the Palestinians began constructing their first parliament building. But when the peace process fell by the wayside and violence slapped the region, the half-finished parliament building became an afterthought. Monocle contributor Mary Pelletier went to the East Jerusalem neighbourhood of Abu Dis to see why this sandy-coloured monolith is still stuck in limbo.
Our parliament.
This is Khaled, the guard who holds the key to the Palestinian parliament building in the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Abu Dis. At this parliament building, there are no security checks, no metal detectors, no guides, and no parliamentarians. Palestinian leadership began construction on the parliament in the mid-90s, during the hopeful era of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Today, it stands incomplete and empty, locked away behind two huge gates.
So here we are in the former Palestinian Parliament, or what was to become the Palestinian Parliament. It's a two-tier theatre. The cement building was never finished on the inside, so it's just sort of a skeleton. No fixtures, no furnishings. Very dusty. Dog paw prints and all the dust along the stairwells. Old Arabic newspapers. It's just a jungle of wires hanging from the undercarriage of the second level. It's completely empty.
From the outside, the Parliament building looks nearly complete. The white, untouched stone facade is missing only its windows and doors. But inside, the traditional tiered plenum hall, where future Palestinian ministers would have met to discuss and pass legislation, is caught between construction and ruin. Ziad Abu Zayed, a former member of the Palestinian Legislative Council who was involved in the Oslo peace process, watched the building start to go up in Abu Dis before any parliamentarians had even been elected.
It was built as a parliament, and they started constructing the building even before there was a Palestinian parliament, before the creation of the Palestinian Authority. So they agreed, they wanted to build that building in Abu Dis, and they wanted that building to be the future parliament for Palestine. And they did not realize at that time that Abu Dis is Abu Dis, it's not Jerusalem. It can't be a substitute for Jerusalem. And after that building was built and they came inside the Palestinian territories, they started to realize and understand that that building cannot be the Palestinian parliament.
The location of the parliament in Abu Dis proved contentious for both Palestinians and Israelis. The building itself was constructed directly on the municipal border of Jerusalem. But after the peace process fell apart and the violence of the Second Intifada broke out in 2000, the building was sealed off, its fate dictated by its location in Israeli-occupied Area B, where Israel retained security control.
When we had elections, and I was elected to represent Jerusalem District in the first Palestinian parliament. We had our offices in Ramallah and our meetings in Ramallah. Because Ramallah was Area A, and we could not function in Area B, which was Abu Dis, and because there was an internal debate between us and on the highest circles of the Palestinian Authority about Jerusalem, we refused to move to Abu Dis and function from Abu Dis because we were worried that somebody wants Abu Dis to be a substitute for Jerusalem.
Today, the borders of Abu Dis are defined by the Israeli separation wall, physically cutting off the town from Jerusalem. The 8-meter-high concrete wall looms over the empty parliament building, obscuring its view of Jerusalem's iconic golden Dome of the Rock. Shortly after the wall went up, and it was clear the parliament would never function there, the Palestinian leadership decided it would be better suited for Al-Quds University, its main campus just a 2-minute drive away.
It's designed to be a parliament with a very nice dome, and under the dome is the main, you know, meeting place. The building was constructed and finished without tiling, without internal design, without nothing. It's only the exterior. But until now, we couldn't manage to get funding.
This is Professor Hassan Dweck, a chemistry professor and vice president of communications at Al-Quds University, who has taught there since 1983. He witnessed the parliament go up, the peace process collapse, and about 10 years ago saw the parliament building transferred over to the university.
Now, at that time, you know, we needed the space over there, and we thought we could, you know, use it for lectures. We could use it for, at some stage, a big cultural center for activities, celebration, big events. Okay. But unfortunately, the financial problem prevented us from the construction because it needs a couple of millions of dollars in order to be ready. And still, it's closed until now.
For people in Abu Dis and around Abu Dis, what do they think when they see the parliament now? Is it like the symbol of the peace process not finishing, or do people think of it as the university's building now? How do people think about it?
No, I think people say it's a pity that such a great building, which was supposed to be a big symbol for representing the Palestinian people, it's closed and unused. And the peace process is not working. It's a sad. It's very sad for us.
To me, it sounds like you see possibility in that building rather than focusing on the past.
No. I'm very optimistic that one day the wall will be, you know, destroyed or demolished, and the building will be part of Jerusalem, and access is free to this building for the communities.
Plans for any sort of cultural center or lecture halls are on hold until the university can raise the money to fund the building's completion. Until then, it remains a relic of the peace process, stuck on the border of Jerusalem. For Monocle, in East Jerusalem, I'm Mary Pelletier.
Still to come on the show, we set our bearings on Belgrade to meet a team looking to give some of Europe's out-of-use buildings a new lease of life. Plus, a word with Grafton Architects, the winners of the inaugural Reba International Prize for their University of Technology and Engineering building in Lima.
Hankering for a few ideas for the year ahead, or in mind of some reflection on the one that was. Monocle's mighty whacker of a December-January double issue is on newsstands now. What more could you want this festive season? Well, here's what our elfin editors have wrapped up for you.
In the affairs section, it's a soft power special. We're at the diplomatic training school in Myanmar. Plus, of course, this year's soft power survey as a familiar face returns to the top spot.
In the business section, we start with 15 lessons to take with you into 2017, such as how best to rethink the food chain and how to run an eyewear shop with impeccable service.
In culture, we set our sextant to 2017 to gauge the high seas of culture, the best books, music, movies and art, and the ones to watch that make it for next year.
Monocle's Mammoth December-January double issue is on newsstands now. Pick up a copy today, or why not treat yourself to a subscription? Head to monocle.com to find out more.
Belgrade used to be the capital of Yugoslavia. Now it's the largest and capital city of a considerably diminished Serbia. And that's left it with all sorts of redundant buildings. Think banks and army barracks, all designed to serve a much larger country than they've found themselves within. Campaigners say these places could be repurposed to the benefit of the population. But these voices have struggled to be heard. So they've called on experts from other European countries with experience of turning white elephants into something a little more useful. Monocle's man in Belgrade, Guy Delaunay, reports.
If you want white elephants, you've come to the right city. In fact, they even welcome you on the drive from the airport. That's the Western City Gate, built right at the end of the Tito era, where the revolving restaurant ground to a halt many years ago. And as you cross the River Sava, you'll see another symbol of thwarted ambition. I'll let Eva Chukic of campaign group Ministry of Space explain.
The former bank in Zeleny Venac, that's, I don't know, it's also a tower. I don't know if you notice, it doesn't have, it's just a skeleton. But you can see it almost from any parts of the city center. So when you're entering Belgrade, the old town, from three bridges, actually, you can see that white, huge tower, which is completely demolished and left like that for years. And even there was even we had a proposal what to do there, maybe one day installation or whatever, just make some use of it, make some buzz around it. And there was no, let's say, maybe a wheel or I don't know what from the other side. Also, there is a problem with, again, with the ownership status, to whom it belongs, how we can use it.
This is something of a recurring theme in Belgrade. Decades of turmoil have left plenty of unused buildings and ownership uncertain, thanks to the end of socialism and a still incomplete restitution process. That makes repurposing the white elephants even more of a challenge.
Some former owners that got their property back, they don't want to use it because it's a huge taxes they have to cover. So they also don't want their property back. So maybe we can figure out the model of temporary use, which can engage those buildings for 3, 5, 10 years and then figure out what to do with them. There is no interest on the market, so you will never sell it. And you have enormously big expenses for maintenance of the building. Then it goes also around the infrastructure that belongs to the building, then also the whole neighborhood has a problems with if it's empty.
This could be part of the solution. It's a conference on new models of property management. Ministry of Space have brought in speakers from Spain and Italy who've made the leap from pressure groups to politics. That's allowed them to influence what happens to the white elephants in their cities.
My name is Claudia Delso. I'm from Spain, from the northwest of Spain, from a city called A Coruña. And since 1 year and a half, I'm the councillor of a new department called Participation and Democratic Innovation in the city. In the last 10, 15, 20 years, Spain built this bubble of big projects for infrastructures like fast train stations, airports that were not really need. And now, of course, when the crisis arrived, this bubble broke, no? And we have some examples, clear examples of white elephants, like the Castellón airport. We have this airport that it was not really need, but it was built. Huge airport and it has no movement, no airplanes arriving or so it's really like a kind of empty space, but of course made with public money, and that's what it has to be denounced, and I think what we have to talk about. No?
The conference also featured an Italian perspective. Campaigners from Messina on Sicily also took the route into local politics. Now their movement, Cambiamo Messina del Basso, is in power there. Federico Alagna came to Belgrade to share their experiences. He explained how blocking the privatisation of a waterfront warehouse offered a model for alternatives to white elephant developments.
We started with a very small project because, of course, the space was very big. We had no money. We started with a very, very small project, which was a recovery for homeless people. When you have such big spaces, you can also use a lot of creativity, and so you can have in the same place a recovery for homeless people and a cultural center, which is actually what we're trying to realize. And if you let the creativity flow, then big things can come.
Mm. How do you challenge the orthodoxy that has been in place, this idea that things should be sold off, should be given over to private developers?
It really helped a lot, also a big social and political fight that our community fought for maybe something like 15 years against the construction of what would have been a white elephant, but a very big one, which is the bridge over the Straits of Messina, connecting Sicily and Calabria. And I think that it was a process of learning of our community, of understanding the importance of thinking about small-scale activities, small-scale investments, and not about these big things that, at the end of the day, give no contribution to the life of the community.
If Belgrade needs some more local inspiration, it only has to look to another former part of Yugoslavia. Slovenia has reinvented itself as a green destination, and that means it can repurpose a white elephant using those principles, like the new national stadium complex, where funding for a proposed shopping centre fell through. Marko Petelin is from Ljubljana's Institute for Spatial Policies.
The architectural community has taken it seriously. There were proposals made actually by the authors of the project themselves, how to repurpose the construction site for other uses. The proposals went into the direction of using these community-powered projects like urban gardening, street sports, activities that actually are using the let's say self-organization of the people. This utilization of this bottom-up potential that lies in the community, I think, it would be a very smart way to actually move things forward.
So, not just lessons, but potential solutions to Belgrade's own white elephant problem. And campaigners may indeed follow the political route to prevent more vanity projects blighting the city skyline. That would put urban design right at the heart of the next municipal elections. For Monocle, in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delaunay.
Finally on today's show, we're shifting our gaze from ill-fated buildings to fine-looking new ones. Just under a fortnight ago, the Royal Institute of British Architects awarded its inaugural international prize to Grafton Architects for a new building in Lima. The skeletal concrete structure was commended for its innovative reimagining of a university campus within a vertical structure. Not to mention the thoughtful integration of the surrounding landscape and urban environment. We spoke to Grafton's directors Yvonne Farrell and Shirley McNamara about the building, but before that, let's get the view of the legendary British architect Richard Rogers. He headed up the judging panel and joined Henry Rees Sheridan, this show's producer, in studio to say a bit more about the prize and why Grafton were the willing recipients.
Whereas the gold medal is for the life work, this is for a building. What it's looking for is the most outstanding building that one can imagine or can find, and give it the prize. And of course, it's a very difficult because it's a global prize, and that's very difficult to know what's going on around the world.
Let's talk about the winning entry. Who won and what did they win for?
Grafton Architects, well-established, very good quality firm based in Dublin, won the competition for a university school in Lima, poor city, a wonderful country, and it was a breath of fresh air, not only, I think, to all of us in terms of the international field, but also in Lima. Lima, and specifically Peru again, has a fantastic history, starting with pre-Columbian and going on to now. I know Lima well. I know Peru pretty well. I go there because of the great architecture of, shall we say, pre-Columbian times. To find a really modern 21st century building is extremely exciting. It's a vertical structure, very open-ended, so it can meet changing needs, and that's one of the major areas of change. In other words, not only has technology changed, but also the way we use buildings has changed, and specifically, obviously, buildings such as schools and offices. Schools are changing in response to pressures from outside, from learning from other people and learning from oneself. And here you've got an open-ended concrete structure. Open-ended, by that I mean air comes through it, and of course it's a very hot climate, so you have to try and make it work without lots of air conditioning, and it does work very well in that way. And you also have to assume that whatever the size of the classes are today, they won't be the size of the classes tomorrow. So you've got to be able to do all these changes. And this is really a skeleton. It's a skeleton upon which you can put different activities and hang it onto that skeleton. And that's what's exciting. And they've made out of this skeleton, this concrete skeleton, mainly of walls, actually, rather than columns and beams. They've made out of the skeleton a very dramatic statement to a city which is in a very poor health. in terms of urbanism. So it's really a remarkable building. As you enter Lima, you see this building sitting on this hillside, and your breath is taken away. It is really very, very good.
Richard Rogers there. Now here's Yvonne Farrell and Shelley McNamara, the directors of Grafton Architects, talking about the building that secured them the prize. Yvonne gave her take first.
The interesting thing for us was that it was a place, a city that we didn't know, on the other side of the earth, as I said, 12 degrees from the equator, with the von Humboldt current coming up from Antarctica, keeping the city at a constant in the 20 degrees Celsius. And for us, this was an equation. We have just finished an exhibition in the Venice Biennale under the heading The Physics of Culture. And for us, the issue of making a new campus in a city with those kind of climatic benign conditions meant that we had the opportunity to rethink the idea of campus.
I think the other thing we found was that because of the climate that Yvonne has mentioned and the culture, because the building was quite robust, I mean, it's really like a piece of, we call it social infrastructure. It's almost like a viaduct or an aqueduct or something. And because everything is external except the teaching rooms, it somehow had a robust quality in the sense that it could survive the fact that we were thousands of miles away and couldn't attend to the construction site in the way that we might normally do. So somehow the climate allowed us to build at this distance away and somehow know that, yes, the building would change and adjustments would be made, but that we felt quite confident that it would survive that kind of distant relationship. I think it was also, as Yvonne says, the local architects we had who were fantastic to work with and really were on the same wavelength, and so the project was sort of nursed through. But we also found that working in Lima was it was very liberating for many reasons. I think because of the vision and the attitude of the client to education, there's a kind of generosity of spirit to education there which we haven't experienced in Ireland, let's say. For instance, it's a university of engineering and it's the client is a mining engineer, but they've included a theatre and a cinema and exhibition space so that there's an overlap between culture and science embedded in the brief. And even though the programme was fast, it always seemed kind of civilised in terms of the relationships and the way of communicating on site. It wasn't an us and them situation. It was very much a collective effort.
Yvonne Farrell and Shelley McNamara there, speaking to this show's producer, Henry Rhys Sheridan. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. My very special thanks to our ever-patient editor, Alex Funnell, and the show's producer in absentia, Henry Rhys Sheridan. Our special thanks also to the girl behind the glass, Claire Urban, and research this week from Daphne Karnesis. If you have any comments or queries, then do feel free to drop this show's producer, Henry, a note at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back at the self-same time next week. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. And please do leave us a review on the latter. It really helps people find the show. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fennett. Until next time, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.